Father Hardin speaks on the subject, the Holy Family.
An essential part of any retreat is to make some decisions regarding one's spiritual life. Without such decisions, we may have profited spiritually from the prayers we have offered and the conferences we've heard, but we've not exactly made a retreat. These resolutions involve two levels of our Christian life. First of all, taking stock of the obstacles that stand between us and the more perfect service of God. Those obstacles are all somehow the result of our sinful tendencies, either because we've been born with them, or over the years, through our sinful indulgence, we have acquired. That's the first level. What things need removal? The second level, and the one we are considering in this conference, is what virtues, corresponding to my sinful tendencies, am I to practice? In general, for all practical purposes, the virtues that in God's providence we are mainly called upon to practice correspond to the wrong tendencies that by now we pretty well know belong to this person called by my name. There should be no secret, at least not to ourselves, about what virtues we most need. We mainly need the virtues of which we obviously have the opposite, vices or sinful tendencies. In other words, the virtues we are to practice are our failings in reverse. And these failings are those that we have either given into from our natural fallen humanity, all that we may have made into what I call bad habits because we have failed to cooperate with God's grace. I suggest we reflect on the Holy Family of Nazareth. And as we go through the virtues of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, ask ourselves, how am I practicing this virtue? We're going to consider 9 virtues. Again, just a rough figure. Each one of us needs all 9. Some of us need one more than another. Others may need all 9 desperately. We begin with Saint Joseph. Says Teresa of Avila, although you have recourse to many saints as your intercessors, though especially to Saint Joseph, because he has great power with God. I would single out these 3 virtues in St. Joseph. Would you? That revelation tells us he practiced. He was prudent, he was faithful, and he was diligent. I therefore commend 3 Josephite virtues to each of you: prudence, faithfulness, and diligence. We begin by noting that he was head of the Holy Family. what in odd words Joseph was the superior of Jesus and Mary. Though quite obvious, he was not superior to Jesus and Mary. But he was the superior of the most sublime community that ever graced this world. And what a superior. He was first of all prudent. Joseph's prudence made him recognize and respect the dignity of the two persons under his care. He had no doubt about Mary's holiness. And one of the hardest things for a father or mother, or new in this community, for a superior, is to recognize the holiness of those under his or her care. The nearest experience vicariously that I've had in this respect was little Jean, whom I stood for as godfather when she was baptized, just before I entered the Jesuit novitiate. Father was a card-carrying communist, and the mother was a Catholic. But he allowed the child to be baptized. Very soon, much earlier than I understand normally, Jean began to talk, and talk very intelligently. By the age of 3, she was telling her mother how much she loved God. And she told her, "Mother, I love you very much, but I love God more." She began to tell her from the time she began to talk, "And God loves me so much, he's going to take you from me from you soon." She made her first communion on her deathbed at the age of 5. I have invoked Jean many times. God is no respecter of either persons or agents when it comes to sanctity. Joseph recognized that he was head of the family, but what a family! I cannot think of a more important responsibility in father or mother than to recognize the working of grace in their children. In fact, everything else pales by comparison. Joseph, in his prudence, recognized that he had a role to play. He was, in God's providence, indispensable for the salvation of the human race. He was to shield Mary. After all, as he knew, she was a virgin and a mother. You don't go around explaining that to people. Imagine the sublime prudence that he had to practice in everything he said about Mary, in whatever he said about Jesus, of which the clearest single evidence is the fact that we don't have a word of his recorded in the four Gospels, though I'm sure he talked. He had great reserve. The first law of prudence is the gift of silence. Having said this, we ask ourselves, how am I doing? Prudence is the knowledge of what to do and what not to do at the right time, according to the will of God. Prudence is knowing what to say and what not to say at the right time. And I would emphasize, at the right time. A minute too soon or a minute too late, and you can sin gravely against the virtue of prudence. Not to know who's listening when you speak. Can be a failure in prudence. To add one adjective to a sentence that doesn't belong there can be a grave failure in prudence. May I commend to all of you, read soon the third chapter of James's letter. You know, St. James wrote a letter. Much of the third chapter has to do with speech. It is frightening on what he says about our capacity to control our tongue. So we think we're holy, do we? The index of sanctity is the ability I have to use my tongue prudently. How we need prudence, and of all places, in the practice of virtue. That, frankly, is the last thing you might think you would need prudence for. But we need prudence in the practice of prayer. Did you know that? We need prudence in the practice of humility. Did you know that? In the practice of charity. But am I not supposed to love everyone? Yes. Don't you dare show your love for everyone in the same way. If you do, you're going to sin, and sin gravely. But I'm supposed to love people. Of course. But how? No matter what virtue you name, the Church tells us the queen of all virtues is prudence. Joseph was faithful. His fidelity to Jesus and Mary cost him a great deal. We are reading this into the text, but we may be sure that the things he was called upon to do in his loyalty to those two sacred souls cost him a lot. He went about quietly, yet his actions spoke for his words. In fact, sometimes I'm almost tempted to say that otherwise good people can be classified into two groups, the talkers and the doers. Some people talk a great spiritual life, budding Jones of the Cross, fledging Catherines of Siena. If you didn't know them from the way they behaved, you would honestly think they were confirmed mystics. Yet maybe the only thing mystical about them is their vocabulary. I've taught over 500 Jesuit priests, and I've warned them, don't judge sanctity by the person's talk. Joseph's loyalty to the Master is imitable. For us it means loyalty, or that loyalty, to Jesus and Mary, as in Joseph's case, which is mainly shown in our deeds. Say, as members of a family, it means loyalty to our family. There are certain things that certain people have to do, otherwise the family suffers. Suppose the task is either not done or has to be done by someone else. In any case, whatever else family means, it means that the members of that family collaborate. We don't ask whether someone else is doing what they're supposed to do. We ask, am I doing what I'm supposed to do? And we do it. That's my homemade definition of loyalty. Doing what I'm supposed to do. For the society, the family, to which I belong. Finally, Joseph was diligent. Sometimes people forget there's a virtue that corresponds to the capital sin called sloth. But there has to be a virtue corresponding to the seven capital sins. Well, just for the record, the virtue corresponding to the sin of sloth, otherwise known as laziness, is diligence. There are two words, diligence and industry. Isn't that terrible how the word industry has just lost its precious moral meaning? In plain Anglo-Saxon, it's the virtue of work. Joseph worked. There's only one term used in the Bible to describe Jesus in his relationship to Joseph. I quote, he was believed to be the son of a laborer. That's the original Greek. We are to serve God not only with our hearts, but also with our hands. In fact, the service of our heart becomes suspect unless we put it into practice by working. Among the precious episodes described in the life of Mother Cabrini, on one occasion after her many visits with Pope Leo XIII, and she was coming back to the United States, his parting message, which she remembered and passed on to others, was, Cabrini, his parting words were, let's love God with the sweat of our brow. I like that. That's mysticism reduced to practice. So how do you love God? By sweating. Anytime you go to bed at night and you're not tired, be sure to confess that the next time you go to the sacrament. I mean it. The rest of the world envies our nation for being a leisure society. But God help this nation if we don't live up to the law of work. It's a law. One of the fine passages in the Old Testament that pertains here, again, apologies for the Latin. avis ad volatum homo ad laborem. Man is born to labor as the bird is born to fly. If we are not working, I hope you'll remember this, we are offending God. That doesn't mean necessarily with muscle, lifting up heavy weights. In fact, I've taught too many Jesuit scholastics who would do anything. One man offered to unload a 40-ton carload of coal. Anything but study. Joseph here is a perfect model for us to imitate. It does not really matter what we are doing. There is no such thing, it doesn't exist, as demeaning labor when it is done as Joseph did his in the company of Jesus and Mary. That's why one of my customs, when I have the time, either on the premises where I live, or even in airports, I will stop and talk to women, for example, or men for that matter, you know, picking up the litter, or mopping. I stop and say, "How are you?" I like to meet people who do the kind of work that my mother used to do. She cleaned office buildings to see me through school. She worked till the day of her death, literally. Always lowly, humble, as they call, unskilled labor. What matters in work is not what we are doing, but why. And the reason is two names, Jesus and Mary. Now, Mary. The Blessed Virgin is after Christ, the most perfect pattern for our imitation. After all, she was a teacher like the rest of us. Unlike her son, she was not a divine person. She was, and this too, I think, calls for emphasis, a woman. Mary was many things, and she had many virtues, as the litany of Our Lady, in fact, it is a litany of her virtues. Do you want an assignment as a result of this retreat? Memorize the litany of Our Lady. And if you have the nerve to tell me, later on. But if you say you've memorized it, I'll take time out to listen. Once more, three virtues in Mary that, out of so many others, deserve our imitation. Her resignation, her compassion, and her prayerful recollection. Mary was resigned to the divine will. We might almost say that another name for Mary would be Fiat, be it done. You might say, but that's a passive verb. Sure, it's a passive verb. The only difference is that the one that Mary was passive to was her God. In the late 19th century, the same Pope Leo XIII that I've already quoted wrote a much neglected and maligned encyclical on Americanism. Sometimes I wish we Americans would just sit down and reread that encyclical. It was prophetic. He told us Americans that we have great virtues, but he also reminded us that we have problems. And our biggest problem, so the Pope said, is that we always want to be up and doing things. It was he who coined, this is Pope Leo XIII, the difference between active and passive virtues. And he said Americans tend to be embarrassed and ashamed of practicing what they call the passive virtues, all of which can be synthesized in resignation to the will of God. And that's the heresy of Americanism. And what you may not know, because it was a papal document, it has entered the literature of the whole Catholic world. Americanism, in the language of all nations except America, means the heresy of insisting that the only virtues that really matter are the active. What does the virtue of resignation mean for us? Every one of us, as creatures, is bound, as the fundamental law of our existence, to practice this virtue, which means that we allow God to do with us, and to us, and through us, whatever He pleases. Don't tell me that's easy. How can we say that we allow God to do anything? After all, He's God. Oh, yes. But instead of resignation, there can be resistance. That's the opposite. Resignation. You might say that this is all there is to life. Again, you might object he is doing it, or he is going to do it, regardless. Not quite. Sure, God is going to do to us whatever He pleases, but not with us, unless we want to. How many times we're tempted to ask, Lord, why me? And the Lord answers, why you? Who do you think you are? How dare you question what I am doing? Who brought you into the world? My mother. Who brought your mother into the world? In other words, you just don't argue with God. We know there's a problem here, and I don't want to minimize it. The problem is that this allowing God to do things to us is so often apparently done by other human beings This is where our faith comes in. And this is where Mary is such a perfect inspiration for us. Mary lived by faith.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.